developed a pretty detailed plan for suicide. But while sitting in my truck, ready to proceed, a thought hit me. To die by my own hand is not my birthright. It's not the way of the warrior. Warriors have a deep appreciation for life and are not victims of circumstance. Desperate, Paul reached out to the Boulder Crest Retreat in Virginia, a highly respected in-residence center for veterans, active duty military, and first responders seeking to heal the hidden wounds of trauma. There he learned transcendental meditation. What I learned at Boulder Crest was excellent, but much of it didn't apply to everyday life outside of the retreat center, like equine therapy or archery, he told me. TM is different. You can take it anywhere and do it anytime, at home, on an airplane, sitting in traffic, anywhere. Veterans need this meditation. We need to learn how to regulate so we can be calm, cool, and collected at home, just like we were trained to be on the battlefield. TM has worked for me, and it has worked for thousands of my brothers and sisters. It has given me the opportunity not to just survive on Earth, but to thrive here, and to live a life that is truly full of purpose, meaning, connection, and service. 5 years ago, the U.S. Department of Defense funded a $2.4 million clinical trial to evaluate the effects of transcendental meditation on the severity of trauma symptoms as well as depression when compared with prolonged exposure, which allows the person to be exposed to a feared object without danger, and also compared to health education control. The randomized controlled study, conducted at the VA San Diego Healthcare System, enrolled 203 veterans with documented post-traumatic stress. Results presented to the Military Health System Research Symposium in August 2017 showed that both the TM group and the group offered prolonged exposure therapy, which has been considered the gold standard for PTSD treatment, significantly decreased trauma symptom severity and depression compared with health education after 3 months. What's more, the benefits were generally higher in the TM group compared to those who underwent prolonged exposure. Dr. Sandy Nittich, co-principal investigator of the study, told me, "Transcendental meditation is a non-trauma-focused treatment and may actually be preferable to other treatments for PTSD, such as exposure therapy, that involve repeated, deliberate contact with anxiety-provoking stimuli." My own story. I can't really ask you to think about what you might get from learning to meditate without telling you what TM has done for me. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1950s and 1960s, inheriting a passion for education from my schoolteacher mother and a deep respect for science and a healthy dose of skepticism from my radiologist father. Dad put himself through medical school in Detroit, delivering newspapers during the Depression, and then went off to World War II as a medic on the front lines of Europe. He came back with a smashed right hip and chronic pain in his hip, knee, and back for the rest of his life. The Surgeon General operated on Dad's hip 3 times and blew each one of the surgeries. During one stint, he was in a body cast for 9 months at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. 9 months in severe pain in a body cast with no air conditioning in the stifling heat of Washington. I can't imagine. I knew this only from my mother, because my father never ever talked about anything from the war. As a kid, I found a box of his medals and was excited to ask about them. He shifted uncomfortably in his chair, looked away, and changed the subject, like I'd shown him an old box of musty-smelling rocks. In fact, none of my friends' dads, almost all of them veterans, ever discussed what they'd seen. Dad was hired as an assistant chief of radiology at the Veterans Administration Hospital at Fort Miley in San Francisco, which sat on a spectacular vista right at the intersection of the Pacific Ocean and the San Francisco Bay. So my parents, my older sister Ellen, and I moved across the country, first to San Francisco for a few months, and then across the Golden Gate Bridge to Greenbrae in Marin County. Within a few years, my brothers Bill and Tom were born. In many regards, it felt like we were a military family. Because my dad was a captain when he was injured, we could shop at the Post Exchange supermarket at Hamilton Air Force Base, a 30-minute drive in traffic north in Novato. It was fairly inconvenient to get there, but it saved a lot of money. As reserved as my dad could be, my mom was the most expansive and loving woman. She had this thing about keeping a constant open house. She knew people at the United Nations office in San Francisco who would call her if a foreign diplomat needed a place to stay. My siblings and I would wake up in the morning to find that a finance minister from Ghana would be living with us for 3 months. She was the emergency call for any foreign exchange student in need of a last-minute placement. Because of Dad's constant pain from his war injuries, my parents put a swimming pool in the backyard for his therapy. If you knew my mom, you could guess what happened. She was a special education volunteer at Merindale School for kids with physical and intellectual disadvantages. She invited her students over for frequent pool day field trips. When she saw how happy that made them, she reached out to an inner-city school in Marin City, organizing visits for them. Sometimes I would come home from school, and there would be a busload of 40 African-American kids in the yard swimming and having fun. Dad hoped I'd be a doctor, but it wasn't for me. When I was 10, he tried to get me interested in medicine by bringing me along to Fort Miley. Saturday mornings, he'd find me throwing my baseball against a concrete wall in front of the garage, scooping up grounders with the worn Willie Mays glove I slept with every night. "Okay, Bobby," he'd say, "we're going to the hospital, and I'm going to read one x-ray, then we'll go to Candlestick Park." Candlestick was where my beloved San Francisco Giants played. The idea of going to a Giants game was it for me. So I would go to Fort Miley and sit in the hospital waiting room. Invariably, one x-ray would become two, and then 10, and then too many for me to count, because there were always emergencies. I used to sit there for hours, and I'd watch these war-torn, sad-faced veterans rolling up and down the sterile corridors in wheelchairs and bandages. Broken men. Seeing their physical and emotional pain left a deep impression on my heart. Maybe that's why I'm drawn so much to work with veterans today. My dad also started volunteering once a week to read x-rays at San Quentin State Prison, a few miles from our home. Believe it or not, there was a restaurant on the prison grounds staffed by inmates who were called trustees. So once or twice a month, my parents would take my sister and brothers and me to dinner there because, surprise, it was less expensive to feed a family of six at a prison restaurant. Now, if you were incarcerated at San Quentin, you were there for something brutal and violent, often murder. But the trustee staff became human to me, and I particularly remember a waiter named Tommy, this big guy who was missing his middle two fingers on his left hand. Tommy always remembered my order, chicken fried steak. Of course, once my friends found out about my prison visits, they all wanted to go. The big thing was to go to my house after school on Friday, go out to dinner at San Quentin with my family, and then return home to watch The Twilight Zone on television and spend the night. After lights out, my friends would dream up the crazy scenarios that must have gotten the guys into prison. I'd play along, but I really began to wonder what horrible things they'd been through in their lives that landed them behind bars. Probably because of my upbringing, at an early age I had a fascination with politics and was drawn to public service as a career. Like most of the kids I grew up with, I loved President John F. Kennedy. I remember in the spring of 1963 joining my Boy Scout troop to take up President Kennedy's fitness challenge to hike 50 miles. Even then, I knew I was a very fortunate kid growing up amidst the coastal mountains of the Northern Bay Area. As often as I could, I'd hike and camp outdoors on Mount Tamalpais. By October 1963, I had turned 13, become an Eagle Scout, and fallen in love with Denise Biancolana, my first girlfriend. And then President Kennedy was assassinated. Looking back, I'm sure it traumatized much of the country on a deep level. most especially the kids. It certainly shocked to the core this 13-year-old boy who didn't really know what death was, and I remember feeling so awful and wondering how it was possible the sun could come up tomorrow. How can things just continue? It did, though it was not the same. In the fall of 1967, my senior year in high school, I, along with so many other kids at the time, woke up to a world in turmoil. Like so many people, I had become enamored by President Kennedy's brother, Bobby, when he became a senator from New York. His vision became my vision, to create a more equitable and just world. It wasn't that I identified closely as a Democrat or Republican. I didn't. I just wanted things to be better. I was accepted into the University of California at Berkeley in October 1968, and my plan was to eventually attend UC Berkeley's law school, become a lawyer, and then become a U.S. senator like Bobby Kennedy. I thought the way to improve people's lives would be through politics and changing public policy. During the summer before my university classes started, I used to tutor a 12-year-old African-American kid, Kenny. He was from a poor family that lived in public housing in Marin City. I would help Kenny, focusing mostly on the reading skills he hadn't been getting at school. It was just Kenny and his mom, and I became close with both of them. On one visit, I borrowed my dad's Nikon camera and took their portrait. I developed the black-and-white photos myself and gave his mom this big 9x13-inch horizontal shot. She loved it. But as I developed the picture and looked at this beautiful, smiling mother and son, I stood there wondering what would happen to Kenny. This wasn't new. I would see Kenny once a week and think about him the rest of the time. He wasn't learning much at school, and the world seemed hell-bent on telling him not to bother. I was able to see Senator Kennedy speak in person at the San Francisco Civic Auditorium on June 1, 1968. I remember the crooner Bobby Darin saying "Mac the Knife" at the rally. And then Senator Kennedy spoke, and I felt I was part of something that could make a difference. It felt good. Then, 4 days later, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Coming just 2 months after the slaying of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the feelings of loss for this idealistic 17-year-old were almost too much to bear. That first year at Berkeley was very tough. The university was in a state of constant upheaval, with war protests devolving into riots. There were helicopters spewing tear gas overhead, and tactical police and National Guard tanks parked outside my dorm. I remember walking home from a physics class on College Avenue and hearing a thunder of feet behind me. I turned around, and there were 30 Oakland tactical police waving billy clubs, chasing me. I had done nothing wrong. Luckily, I ran much faster than they did. I was 18, and the first year of college is supposed to be tumultuous anyway. But with all of the unrest on campus, mine was tumult on steroids. For the first time in my privileged young life, I had an inkling of what it was like to feel unsettled, disconnected, and unsafe. Even small things started to worry me, and outsized reactions to small events just built on each other. Everyone at school seemed to fall into a group: left, right, hippie, jock, or religious fanatic. I was none of them. I didn't take drugs, and I couldn't relate to the political polarization on either side. I was just a guy who thought he was going to transition smoothly from a suburban high school to university life and then help make a difference in the world. The brutally divisive 1968 presidential race between Richard Nixon and Vice President Hubert Humphrey left me disillusioned with pursuing politics as a career path. Inspired by my mother's love of teaching and my memories of working with Kenny and his mom, I decided that I would pursue a doctorate in education instead. My plan was to specialize in developing educational curricula to help underserved kids not just learn the basics, such as algebra, but also to acquire social and emotional tools to survive and hopefully rise above their challenging circumstances. I fervently agreed with the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, who wrote, "Education is not about filling the pail, it's about lighting a fire." While I worked toward that goal, I had a stint to earn some extra cash at Swenson's Ice Cream Parlor on Durant Avenue. It was just north of Telegraph Avenue, where street demonstrations against the Vietnam War were almost a daily occurrence. And it was at Swenson's that I met a co-worker named Peter Stevens. Peter was 26, with a master's degree from Tufts University near Boston, and he was studying landscape design on his own. He worked part-time at Swenson's for the spending money, and people of all sorts liked him because at Berkeley, he was about the only person who seemed down-to-earth and normal, which in Berkeley in 1968 was high praise. I'd worked with Peter about 6 months when, one evening around 10 o'clock, I took a break from studying and went into Swenson's to get some ice cream. I knew Peter was working the late shift, but he was nowhere in sight. "Where's Peter?" I asked another worker. "Oh, he's in the back meditating," she said. "What?" Just the word meditating struck me like an electric shock. It had such a bizarre connotation and really wasn't even in my vocabulary. But when he walked out to the front of the store, there he was, just Peter, but a little brighter than usual, smiling a little more, with a little more serenity on his kind face. I took notice. I asked what he was doing, and he told me he practiced transcendental meditation. Of course I'd heard about it, because the press had made such a big deal of the Beatles going off to India to study TM with Maharishi in early 1968. Sitting in one place with my eyes closed meditating never had been very appealing to me. I saw myself as a doer, a get-it-done kind of a guy. I wanted to change the world, and that required action. I also thought maybe it was a philosophy or religion, and I just wasn't into that. On the other hand, I was pretty stressed out, and I did respect Peter a lot. I found myself curious. I asked him to tell me more. He pointed me in the direction of the TM Center on Channing Way, one block south of College Avenue and a few blocks east of campus. I knew the building. The sign on the outside of it read, in all caps, Students International Meditation Society. I had walked past it many times on my way from my Putnam Hall dorm, heading to my sister Ellen's apartment on Hillside Court in the Berkeley Hills. I decided to trust Peter, take a leap, and attend what was billed as an introductory lecture. The three-story white stucco building had a spacious lecture hall with about 30 chairs lined up theater style in rows. I felt comfortable. It was a normal place. There were no pillows to sit on and no holding hands in a group. A woman in her late 20s gave the talk, and she ran through the basics of the practice and its benefits. At the end, she asked if there were questions. I raised my hand and asked, "This all sounds good, but how much do I have to believe for it to work?" The woman nodded amiably, then she held up a piece of chalk in her right hand. She waited a moment and then dropped the chalk into her outstretched left hand below. "You don't have to believe in gravity for this chalk to fall," she said. "Like that, you don't have to believe in anything to practice TM. In fact," she said, "I could be 100% skeptical and the technique would work just fine." That clicked with me. I liked that I could be a skeptic and didn't have to believe in transcendental meditation for it to work. The only firm conviction I had about it, in fact, was that I was going to be the one person who would be unable to meditate. She assured me that everyone has this nagging suspicion, and yes, anyone can learn. 2 days later, on the sunny Saturday morning of June 28, 1969, I returned to the TM Center to start the course. Sylvia Schmidt was my teacher. She was in her early 30s, a soft-spoken academic. I walked with her into the small instruction room on the second floor of the center. "Okay, I'm here," I thought to myself as I settled into a comfortable chair to her left. As Sylvia led me through the beginning steps of instruction, I felt my mind and body sinking into a state of deep relaxation. Now remember, I was a tightly wound, skeptical 18-year-old kid, and yet, Within seconds of my first experience meditating, I felt this wave of physiological peace come over me. The tension in my neck, shoulders, and stomach muscles were the first to go, and my racing mind settled down. Yet I was fully aware, fully awake. It was both unique and as familiar and natural as could be. Once the meditation was over, I remember thinking to myself, "This is something. It's not just my imagination or visualizing. This is really something." One of my next thoughts was, "I'd like to teach this to kids." I learned quickly that TM was judgment-free. There were no hidden strings, no organization to join, no ongoing dues to pay, no pressure to buy anything. Sylvia told me to meditate again later that afternoon. I was supposed to study at Ellen's place. I didn't want my sister to know just yet that I'd begun meditating, so I told her I was going out in her backyard to read. I had this bright idea to try the meditation on this little deck tucked away on the hillside. There was no chair, so I sat on the wooden planks and I meditated. And I was eaten alive by mosquitoes. I mean eaten alive. I realized then and there you don't have to sit outside to find nature. From then on, when people say, "Oh, let's meditate outside," I think, a room with a chair is nice too. I told my family and they began to notice differences. Ellen started 6 months after I did. When two Roths were the better for it, a month later my parents and my brothers Bill and Tom started. Now I had the satisfaction of seeing, in these people I'd known and loved all my life, just how TM made them feel better, happier, more themselves. My parents continued to meditate until their passing, and my sister and brothers are still at it decades later. In fact, Ellen, who raised two boys and who now spends a lot of time with her grandchildren, and Tom, who runs a market research firm and volunteers to bring TM to people living with HIV, also studied to become TM teachers back in the early 1970s, and both continue to teach today. Bill, a builder of green homes and small office buildings, has been a regular meditator since 1970. Seeing what TM could do for the people I loved, I realized I wanted to be able to teach it to others. In 1972, I heard there was a teacher training course with Maharishi in Mallorca, Spain. It was off-season there, January to May, so nice hotel accommodations were readily available at a low cost. Maharishi instructed me and thousands of others how to teach people to meditate. I loved hearing the discussions, which could evolve into hours and hours, about the deep connections between an ancient science of consciousness and the modern sciences of quantum physics, neuroscience, biochemistry, and psychology. The conversations felt timeless and were both abstract and practical. After I was certified as a teacher, I headed back to the Bay Area, where I taught TM to the public as well as in local schools, businesses, and government agencies. But one of my most searing memories of that time was teaching guards and inmates at San Quentin Prison. I was able to get back there because of a Hell's Angel who was doing time in Folsom State Prison. His name was Pat Corum, and he was a self-confessed murderer. George Ellis, a close friend of mine and a TM instructor, had launched the TM in Prison program in the mid-1970s. He went to Folsom to teach Pat, and it helped him so much that this Hell's Angel went from being the drug connection in prison to the meditation connection. Pat asked George to teach more inmates, and with the results there, the case was made to bring it into San Quentin. Some amazing research was published showing a 50% reduction in recidivism rates, and when you consider that as much as 80% of all crime is from repeat offenders, I could see even back then the potential impact transcendental meditation could have in an overburdened criminal justice system. Let me take you inside the walls at San Quentin back in the early 1980s. If you had to be there for an 8 o'clock evening meeting, you needed to arrive at 6 because it took 2 hours of pat-downs and metal detectors and signed waivers. There was a lot of sitting on old, banged-up metal folding chairs in old, paint-peeled rooms. You'd have to go through four massive gates, and at each one you had to sign something that basically said, "If you're taken hostage, the prison will not negotiate for your release." I remember one night in 1981. It was in a bare, windowless meeting room, and I was there for a refresher course with inmates who had already learned to meditate. There were about 30 men, most too young or too old to be there, sitting in metal chairs. They were of every race, but dressed identically in blue jeans and blue work shirts. The guard for the group was a Baptist minister, who was also a meditator. After the meditation, another guard, who stood by watching the whole thing, came up to me. "That was a first," he said. I thought he was being sarcastic about meditation, but there was no smirk on his face. Nowhere else in prison have I ever seen those particular guys sit together in the same room and close their eyes. Not in the dining hall, nowhere. "Because if you closed your eyes in San Quentin," he explained, "you could end up with a shiv in your back." "Do you realize," he asked, "that you just had the Aryan Brotherhood, Mexican Mafia, and the Black Panthers all in the same room?" We called that prison program in San Quentin Freedom Behind Bars. Meditative Moment: Developing the Intangible for Greatness. Tony Spinoza is Director of Health and Fitness at National Defense University, or NDU, a graduate-level institution in Washington, D.C., for members of the U.S. Armed Forces. NDU was established to prepare military and civilian leaders to anticipate and counter emerging security threats with a rigorous study of military strategy, global engagement, and tech research. Before joining NDU, Tony served 20 years in the U.S. Army and retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1999. He coached freshman football at West Springfield High School in Northern Virginia, earned a master's degree at George Mason University, and was then hired as the strength coach for the Washington Redskins professional football team under Coach Joe Gibbs. A few years later, he accepted the fitness leadership role at NDU because it would allow him, he said, to expand the definition of fitness to include a mental and spiritual element as well as physical conditioning. Tony's focus at National Defense University is to provide the tools and techniques to promote lifelong health and fitness to his students, most of whom are in their early 40s and 50s, and many of whom will go on to become generals and admirals in the U.S. military. He also mentors NDU faculty and staff. Here's what Tony said. "We work on three aspects of fitness. First is diet and exercise. We work with individuals who have metabolic syndrome, high cholesterol, and other health issues. Second, we work in the areas of cognitive performance, enhancing memory and focus. And third, we promote spiritual wellness. That means we deal with the intangibles of who we are, what drives us to succeed, and what moves us to achieve greatness." I always wanted to bring meditation into the NDU curriculum to promote all three areas of our concern. I did a lot of reading up on the science of meditation. I tried several different types of mindfulness techniques and guided meditations. Personally, I didn't find them easy to do. I couldn't get my brain to rest or my mind to settle down. Then last year, my thoracic surgeon, Dr. Hassan Teta, suggested I try transcendental meditation. So I started, and I found it to be incredibly easy to learn and practice. It has already done great things for me. I'm able to focus a lot better, think more clearly, and I'm less anxious. I don't get stressed out over situations and circumstances that used to bother me. Before offering TM to my students, I was sure there would be some skepticism, some resistance. It was the opposite. I was surprised at how many were already educated, already open. Of the 600 graduate-level students, more than 100 learned TM within the first several weeks of the new school year, and there is now a sizable waiting list for others to start as well. What I appreciate about TM is that it rests and rejuvenates a part of my brain that ordinarily never gets rest. The morning meditation gets me ready for the day, and the afternoon meditation clears out the stress of the day from my brain and body. My wife learned too, and we meditate together whenever we can. I love teaching people to meditate, all sorts of people, but working with kids has always had a special place in my life. Because going back to my roots, if you want to create a better world, it has to begin with young people. I found someone of like mind in 2004. He was the great filmmaker, painter, musician, woodworker, sculptor, and longtime TM practitioner David Lynch, who you heard about earlier. We became fast friends, like brothers, first working together on a project to build a large meditation center in Los Angeles. Several months later, I spoke with David and Dr. John Hagelin, a Harvard-trained quantum physicist who heads up the TM organization in the United States. I spoke about my long-standing desire to bring TM to young people. "Let's start a foundation," I said. "Good idea," David and John agreed. "We should put it in your name, David," I replied. "All right," he said. "Can I send out a press release to announce the David Lynch Foundation?" "Sure," he said, most likely thinking not much would come of it. The press release was picked up by the major wire services, and within a few days, news stories of the formation of the David Lynch Foundation began appearing in thousands of newspapers all over the world. It was really as simple as that. No great forethought, no 5-year business plan, no money even, just a genuine shared desire to do something good for the world. And so much good has come of it, and so much of it is due to David's true genius, his extraordinary creativity, conviction, and energy. David's foundation was born on July 21, 2005, in partnership with Dr. Hagelin and the TM Organization, a nonprofit that trains certified teachers to teach the programs and which administers more than 150 TM teaching centers nationwide. For the first few years, we offered the meditation to whatever school or organization wanted it. So if a school for American Indian teens living on an impoverished reservation outside of Lincoln, Nebraska, wanted a program, we would raise the money and pay for it. Or if there was a prison willing to let us come in, we would go and find a way to fund it. So it was with urban schools in crime-ridden neighborhoods, women's shelters, veteran service organizations, and HIV clinics in the United States and abroad. In April 2009, the David Lynch Foundation hosted our first benefit concert at New York's Radio City Music Hall, with headliners Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, along with Donovan, Mike Love of the Beach Boys, Jerry Seinfeld, Howard Stern, and many others. Our goal? To raise the funds to teach 1 million at-risk youth around the world to meditate. We were sure the announcement would be greeted with great positivity and fanfare among the New York City philanthropic community. Wrong. The complaints poured into our office. Why are Paul and Ringo wasting their time performing for meditation? The concert came right after the 2008 financial collapse, and the feeling among many in New York was that with philanthropic dollars scarce, why drain them off for something as frivolous as meditation for kids? What about raising money to build more schools, cure malaria, end poverty? All genuine questions that demanded answers. At the time, we were working with a wonderful woman, Debbie Fife, who had organized fundraising events in New York City for 20 years. She said for us to be successful, we would have to demonstrate that the David Lynch Foundation was a survival charity, that we were addressing a life-or-death concern that merited public support and private funding. There are countless survival charities that do incredibly valuable work, tackling the epidemics of cancer, heart disease, cystic fibrosis, HIV, and so on. What had been missing, I thought, was an organization that addresses with singular focus and expertise the crisis of toxic stress and trauma among vulnerable, at-risk populations. We took Debbie Fife's advice. For several years, we organized a series of national science conferences, led by top researchers, physicians, educators, and policymakers, to showcase the damaging effects of trauma on the brain and behavior, as well as the decades of research and clinical experience using TM to address this terrible epidemic. Fast forward to today, and with the growing recognition of the horrors of trauma and the unique benefits of TM, our programs are now in high demand in private and public schools, on military bases, in prisons, women's shelters, and HIV clinics. Yes, we are sometimes greeted with a bit of skepticism, but compared with even 5 years ago, there is very little hesitation or doubt. Thankfully. Every day I read in the newspapers that mental health is increasingly at the forefront of the national debate, and for good reason. The elephant in the room is that no one really knows what to do about it. Do we medicate every child who may be a bully or is bullied? Do we continue to hand out cocktails of drugs to veterans with post-traumatic stress? While the medications are helpful for some, too many vets are non-compliant. Many don't like the numbness and disorientation they often feel medicated up, and so they refuse to take the drugs. Maybe they just want something better. Meditative moment. Charged at 100% battery. Katy Perry has sold a zillion albums, give or take, and won countless awards for her music. She's the first person in the world to have 100 million Twitter followers and has been at the top of the pop star universe for more than 10 years. That's a century in normal human years. I taught Katy to meditate in 2010 when she was in India with comic actor Russell Brand getting married. She is a kind, authentic, and generous woman. Katy recently invited me to be a guest on her YouTube live webcast, which reached more than 49 million people. Katy calls her TM practice a game changer, one that allows her to bring her very best to every situation, no matter how pressure-packed and demanding. Katy says, "Fundamentally, TM is the deepest rest I ever get. I dream a lot when I sleep, and this means I never fully get the rest that I need. Rest is so important for me and my vocals because I operate best when I'm not tired. So I'll meditate before a show, which really helps. You would think I would fall asleep, but it actually leaves me feeling very re-energized. Paris Fashion Week, I was out all night with friends, and then I had to get up early for the runway shows. By the second show, I was a zombie. I meditated, and my friends thought the change in me was hysterical. Like I was Mary Poppins. Here I am. I'm wide awake. They were like, whoa, I want to learn that. And I say, do it. TM training is my absolute favorite gift to give because it would be a shame not to share it with people who are suffering. I see their lives change, and I see how much joy and peace it brings them. I have a friend with PTSD who is finally able to sleep through the night. But it's not just people who have specific problems like that. We can all use it. We live in a world where personal time is obsolete. We're going to bed with our phones right here in front of our faces. We're never allowing our brain to rest anymore, which is so important for creativity, no matter what your job is. You have to install a practice that helps your mind kind of reboot, just like your phone does sometimes. You've got 18 apps open on your phone, it's going to shut down on you. In the same way, you need to unplug just for 20 minutes twice a day, and then you're good. When I meditate, I physically feel a halo around my head, lighting up, sweeping the cobwebs one by one from around my brain. Thoughts will come and go, and it will be 5 minutes before I can get to that stillness. I go to this incredible place where I'm not even thinking anything, and yes, I'm awake. It's so insane because I do feel like I'm using most of my brain at that moment. I swear I can feel neural pathways opening up. Creatively, I get thoughts and ideas that maybe were buried at the bottom. They were dying to come out, but they were just covered by the dust of stress and fatigue. That effect stays beyond the 20 minutes, and I can see it in my level of performance. I need to be able to live at my fullest capacity, and TM keeps me charged at 100% battery. The Quiet Time Program, also known as Consciousness-Based Education, has been the flagship of the David Lynch Foundation since its launch in 2005. For 2 15-minute periods twice a day during each school day, the whole school is quiet. Students have a choice during that period. They can meditate or do something called silent sustained reading, or they can even nap. With their parents' encouragement and permission, most kids choose to meditate. The purpose of quiet time is to give a short break, twice a day, dedicated not to jamming more facts and figures into their developing brains, but to reducing stress and getting them ready to learn. And it works, as evidenced by the success of quiet time programs in hundreds of public, charter, and private schools all over the United States and around the world. Yes, quiet time reduces stress and helps keep young people off of drugs and out of trouble. But more than that, it wakes up the young person's brain, promotes learning readiness, and creates an optimal learning environment so students can develop their creative potential, assimilate knowledge, raise their academic achievement, and be their best selves. Dr. George Rutherford was the first to see the value of quiet time. Doc, as everyone calls him, is now in his late 70s. He's been a public school principal and teacher for more than 53 years, running middle schools and high schools in some of the toughest, most crime-ridden areas in Washington, D.C. He won't retire. He says he can't retire. He loves teaching and his kids so much. Doc is now the principal of the Ideal Academy Public Charter School, where he has instituted the Quiet Time program for all of his students, teachers, and administrators. When I first met Doc in 1994, he was the principal of the Fletcher Johnson Learning Center, a public high school in the district's Ward 8, where murder rates were at their highest and where Doc held in his arms students with gunshot wounds. Doc was the first public school principal in America to institute quiet time school-wide. I asked Doc at the time why he did it. He explained that a few months earlier, he had made a visit to an amazing small private school located in Fairfield, Iowa. In the middle of nowhere, he said. What he saw at Maharishi School was hundreds of kids in kindergarten through 12th grade attend classes in consciousness-based education, with TM at the core of the otherwise traditional academic curriculum. And while the kids were learning a lot and excelling on academic test scores and in athletic competitions, what Doc noticed first and foremost was they were happy. "That's what I saw, happy kids," Doc said. "And I wanted my kids at Fletcher Johnson to be happy, just like those kids." Now the Quiet Time program that Doc helped to start at Fletcher Johnson has been incorporated into hundreds of schools with hundreds of thousands of kids all around the world. I remember the first time I visited Visitation Valley Middle School in San Francisco. For a long time, it had been one of the worst performing schools in the city. But now it had something going for it. Principal Jim Durkee, a mustachioed, burly guy in his mid-50s. He didn't fit the stereotype of an educator who sees the potential of meditation in school. But he too loved his kids, and he wanted to raise the academic achievement and promote a sense of well-being for the students living in a highly stressed environment. He'd tried everything to combat low attendance, violence, and low performance. Working with the Center for Wellness and Achievement in Education, a nonprofit sister organization to the David Lynch Foundation, Jim started a quiet time program utilizing TM. He began with a group of eighth graders. Compared with their peers who weren't offered consciousness-based education, the quiet time students' suspensions fell by 45%, and test scores jumped significantly relative to the others. Once quiet time was offered to the whole school, within 4 years, the suspension rate was among the lowest in the city. In 2014, students at Visitation Valley took the California Healthy Kids Survey of Social and Emotional Health. They were asked to rank themselves with questions such as, "How much do you feel energetic right now?" and, "Since yesterday, how much have you felt grateful?" Even with all the issues outside of school walls, Visitation Valley scored higher for happiness than any other school in San Francisco, higher than even the most affluent schools where the kids have every advantage. Jim is retired now, but he got his wish for Visitation Valley. happy kids given the opportunity to live up to their potential. Joshua Aronson, a New York University psychologist and co-author of The Social Animal, studies the social forces that shape academic success. Everything from how poverty and prejudice undermine the confidence and learning of minority students and girls, to the effects of student mindsets on their grade point average. Joshua gained renown for developing interventions that boost achievement, but he told me that a visit to Visitation Valley completely reoriented his focus to study the impact of meditation in schools. "I had to take this up. It was just too big to ignore," Joshua said. "I saw children who were noticeably kinder and more peaceful toward one another as a result of the Quiet Time program. I heard 11-year-old kids speaking thoughtfully and with clarity about their feelings. I felt a sense of calm, support, and humanity emanating from the kind of tough-looking inner-city kids who might easily scare you if you saw them on the street. Schools often bring out the worst in children, but Quiet Time brings out the best," Joshua told me. "It's simply the most respectful, effective, and elevating intervention I have ever seen. After a very short period of time, you can feel the kids getting smarter, nicer, and happier. Quiet Time works, and the data continue to bear it out. Research shows a highly significant 10% increase in test scores. That was in a study of 189 middle schoolers who were below the baseline proficiency level in math and English using the California Standards Tests. TM was taught and practiced in the school as it continued with the school's standard curriculum and instruction. At 3 months, the meditating students improved at least one performance level in math and English compared with controls. In another study, 45 African American students aged 15 to 18 were assigned randomly to either a transcendental meditation group or a health education control. The meditation group engaged in 15-minute sessions at home and at school each day for 4 months. The control group was given 15-minute sessions of health education at school each day for 4 months. The results were clear even before the next academic exam. There was an obvious, significant reduction in negative school behaviors with decreases in absenteeism, rule infractions, and suspension days in the meditation group. Naturally, quiet time helps teachers too. Look at a recent study of 40 secondary school teachers and support staffers at the Bennington School in Vermont, a therapeutic school for children with behavioral problems. After 4 months, the faculty and staff showed significant reductions in stress and burnout. Educators also remember why they wanted to become educators in the first place. Educators such as Michael Barakat. "I met Michael a few years ago when I moderated a panel discussion on the Quiet Time program for 200 school principals and other administrators in New York. Afterward, I stuck around for questions when this tall, youthful-looking man in his mid-30s came up. 'We're going to do this,' he said. Now, I confess I was in a Q&A mode, so I was just anticipating questions or concerns. 'Oh, great,' I said. 'I'm glad you're interested.' 'Oh, no,' he said. 'You misunderstand. We're going to do this. What are the next steps?'" I never should have underestimated Michael Barakat, principal of the Bronx High School for Law and Community Service. I found out later that he started there as a principal in 2010, taking on a failing school with a D rating and just points away from an F. Only 47% of the students were graduating in 4 years. "It was made very clear," Principal Barakat told me, "that if we didn't turn the school around, it would be closed." Principal Barakat is achievement-focused and data-driven. The first thing he did was the obvious. He focused on academics. "If I could have changed the name of the school to Reading, Writing, and Arithmetic, I would have," he recalled. "It was a severe first year, but people were not graduating. That's what people are supposed to do from high school. They're supposed to graduate." The first year of focus reset the system, and by 2015, Principal Barakat had raised the graduation rate from 47% to 73%, even before implementing Quiet Time. "I have so many students working their tails off to do everything in their power to achieve the ever-increasing goals that are set for them," he said. "And they are doing this as they face struggles at home. My school is above 85% Title I, meaning the students get free or reduced lunch because their household incomes are below the poverty level, he said. So they have a certain set of socioeconomic disadvantages. When Principal Barakat heard about quiet time, he says he knew it at least deserved a shot. Before bringing the program to his school, he put it to the teachers for a vote. I wanted a majority, he said. To make it work, we had to reduce the students' lunch period from 50 minutes to 35 minutes each day and take 5 minutes off each class period to get to the goal of 18 minutes of quiet time in the morning before second period and 18 minutes after the seventh period. Some teachers expressed concern that a more compressed class schedule would lead to lower student achievement. In an age of high-stakes testing and accountability, he said, I understand that. Principal Barakat negotiated the schedule change with the teachers' union. He was excited with the development, but, he said, he was anticipating what he called a PR nightmare when he brought it up to students and parents. What actually happened was a surprise. Out of the 420 kids at the school, I only had two parents who had differences, he said. So we just set up an alternative where those two students would go help in the main office during those quiet time minutes. The program started on the first day of school in September 2015, and he watched the rollout closely. My main question was, for the 5 minutes that we took off of each class period to make this happen, did we gain 10 minutes of attention? Did we gain 10 minutes of a student's ability to actually listen to the teacher? It seemed to be working soon after the start. It's funny, because we were sitting around racking our brains about what metrics we would use to measure this as success or failure, explained Principal Barakat. Because TM is such a qualitative experience, how could we quantify it? A veteran teacher volunteered an observation. Students don't fall asleep in class anymore, she said. I always had to say to students, especially toward the end of the day, come on, stay awake, it's just a little bit longer. The teachers realized they'd all seen that marked difference. The kids were showing the restful alertness that is a hallmark of TM. More pointedly, the teachers soon saw better test scores, and by the end of 1 year with the Quiet Time program, a jump in the graduation rate. Our rate went up 5 points, and now it's above 78%, Principal Barakat told me with deserved pride. The citywide and statewide averages fluctuate, but they're always somewhere in the lower to mid-60s. To me, that's the ultimate metric, because it's the culmination of all of our other metrics. It all goes to graduation rates. There was also what he heard privately from students. The principal had always had a safe school with good kids, but he knew there were conflicts at home. Someone told me she was about to have a fight with her mom and decided to meditate instead, recalled Principal Barakat. Just as in other quiet time schools across the country, the faculty of Bronx High School for Law and Community Service seemed to benefit along with the kids. When the superintendent came in, as Principal Barakat put it, for a routine white glove inspection, the faculty wasn't as nervous and freaked out as they had been in the past. They were confident and excited to talk about the school. The urgency hasn't left, Principal Barakat said. But the panic about trying to do something that can seem mathematically impossible, given budgets and expectations, that's gone. That difference is palpable. Principal Barakat sees the potential to help kids of all socioeconomic levels. Having spoken to colleagues on the other side of the coin, there are tremendous pressures on students coming from what we would call an advantaged background, he said. So in no way am I saying that only poor, underrepresented students need to meditate. Quite the contrary. I think we are doing a disservice to all of our students in K through 12 by sticking to an arcane curriculum that does not teach life skills. And I consider transcendental meditation to be a basic life skill. The University of Chicago Crime and Urban Education Labs are tackling the epidemic of youth violence. Each year, roughly 50,000 people are murdered worldwide. And while mortality rates from almost every other leading cause of death have declined dramatically in the last century, current homicide rates in America are about the same as they were in 1900. The crime lab uses science. harnessing the power of administrative data through randomized, controlled studies to learn about innovative and effective ways to reduce violence. This research helps inform policymakers, academics, funders, and practitioners of what works, for whom, and why, so that every dollar spent to curb violence is spent wisely. In its search for solutions in 2015, the Crime Lab put out a request for proposals for innovative programs and ideas to reduce youth violence through the Chicago Design Competition. "It's where we crowdsource the best ideas," says John Wolfe, senior program manager at the Crime Lab. "We ask people on the front lines who are doing the work, what are the best ideas for tackling this problem?" More than 220 organizations competed for the funding, including the David Lynch Foundation. The Crime Lab, in partnership with the Pritzker Pucker Family Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation, selected the David Lynch Foundation as one of three winners and awarded the DLF office in Chicago nearly $300,000 to study the effects of quiet time in two public schools in distressed neighborhoods in Chicago. "I had some skepticism when we initially looked at the program," John Wolfe told me. "We're going to have high school students do what? Are they really going to want to do that every day?" We knew there was some promising data coming out of schools in San Francisco, but there was some thought of, okay, that's San Francisco, but could this actually be effective in Chicago? We decided to give the David Lynch Foundation a year to prove that it could. The Chicago public school system helped the Crime Lab choose the two schools for the pilot program. At the time of the first interim report in December 2015, the program had been implemented at Amundsen High School and Gage Park High School, and the results were already showing. At Gage Park, an overwhelming majority of students practicing TM said they were feeling less stressed and calmer. And at Amundsen, nearly all the meditating students reported feeling less stress as well as less anxiety with better sleep habits. They also said they were better able to handle the pressures of heavy academic workloads. "After a year of the program, we interviewed students and talked to teachers and administrators," John Wolfe continued. "The enthusiasm of the administrative staff at both Gage Park and Amundsen, as well as their claims of improved conduct among students in the program, is promising. The full-scale research project will be able to determine whether the positive changes that the administrators attributed to quiet time are caused by the program." The program has received glowing reports. One school in particular chose a group of students who historically had a lot of mental health issues because of the track they were on academically and the pressures they faced. The school reported that there were zero official mental health reports out of the group of 60 students in the program. After gathering all of the information from the pilot program, the Crime Lab increased its grant by nearly $1 million in 2016. So that the program could be offered in three more public schools, again in some of the toughest areas of the city. The three schools selected by the Chicago Public School System and the Crime Lab are in the south and west of the city, historically its most disadvantaged and violent areas. The study has school classes randomized where every student in a class either meditates or doesn't meditate, but does another quiet activity. The Crime Lab is comparing outcomes between the two groups in regard to attendance, suspensions, grades, standardized test scores, and arrests. John Wolfe told me that through focus groups conducted at both pilot schools, students reported benefits in four main areas. 1. Sleep. 2. Self-awareness and self-control. 3. Ability to focus. And 4. Mood. Sharing that they felt calmer and better able to cope with stress both in and outside of school. This study confirmed that the program could be implemented with fidelity and suggested encouraging avenues along which meditation impacts student health. John said that he finds the data so promising that the Crime Lab is working to secure additional funds to bring quiet time to several thousand more students in Chicago, as well as New York City public schools, in the next few years. I've thrown a lot of data about quiet time at you because I get enthusiastic about the outcomes. But there's one story that is more powerful than any statistic. A couple of years back, I got a call from Ben, an eighth-grade teacher at an urban high school in a tough neighborhood. The school had recently begun a quiet time program, offering TM on a voluntary basis to all its students, faculty, and staff. Ben wanted to tell me about one of his students, an 11-year-old whom I'll call Charlene. At Ben's school, each student has to be in his or her seat before the first period class bell rings to be able to meditate with